today.
1.3 FM.
2 SER.
Hi, I'm Roderick Chambers from The Wire. If you enjoy the stories we bring you weekdays, you can help keep this program on air by signing up as a 2 SER supporter. Like all community radio stations, 2 SER is not for profit and relies on the support of people like you to stay on air. Call us now on 9514 9500 or go online now to 2ser.com/support to make a contribution. Oh, and mention that you love listening to The Wire. Thanks. Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage for current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on The Wire today, we spoke to an international volunteer about what is happening in Syria. Also on the program tonight, an Aboriginal artist has designed a new sanctuary window that blends the Catholic and Indigenous beliefs together in a picture of the Mother Mary and Jesus Christ. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. Sydney and first, in order to combat Sydney and Melbourne's hair-tearing traffic issues, the Grattan Institute has released research which shows that we may need to have a congestion charge. The charge, similar to tolls in a way, would charge people travelling into the city during peak hours. However, the Grattan Institute says this charge needs to be part of a three-stage reform in order for it to really affect traffic conditions. Samantha Smith begins by asking James Ha, an associate at Grattan Institute's Transport and Cities team, what the three stages are.
If governments really want to make a difference on congestion in our largest capital cities, they should start by introducing congestion charging where congestion is most evident, so in the CBDs of our largest capitals. So that should happen within the next 5 years. And a congestion charge around the CBD would work in such a way that people pay a modest fee to drive inbound to the CBD in the morning and pay a similar modest charge to drive outbound in the afternoon, and there would be no other charge at any other time. And so that's the first stage of the reform. And we know, however, that congestion is not just in the CBD. It's clearly everywhere across our cities. So stage two should involve governments charging for access to the most in-demand roads at their busiest times. So we're sort of thinking key arterials across the network. And again, that would be only in the busiest time, in the busiest direction. And then stage three of the reform is to have full road user charging. So that involves drivers paying per kilometre that they drive on the road, paying a higher rate at the busiest times on the busiest roads for more congesting vehicles as well. And that would have to be accompanied by a pretty substantial fairness package. And in particular, it would involve the removal of fuel excise for drivers. There would have to be a swap of that tax.
Do we have the resources now to implement something like a congestion charge?
The technology is now mature enough. It would just involve number plate recognition cameras, and it could be done very soon.
Other countries and cities have introduced a congestion charge, but do you think Sydney and Melbourne cities' congestion can compare to a city, say, like London?
London is probably the most famous congestion charge, but it's in other cities as well. So it's in Singapore, Stockholm, Milan. There's even congestion charging in Malta, and it's about to be introduced in New York. And these cities range in scale enormously. So, you know, London and New York are a lot bigger than Sydney and Melbourne, but Sydney and Melbourne are a lot bigger than Malta.
Those who can afford a congestion charge are those who are driving into the city. I believe that they're 2 to 3 times more likely to earn a six-figure wage. Is that correct?
That's correct. If you're driving to the Sydney CBD, more than half of those people are earning, you know, $100,000 or more per year. And in Melbourne, it's almost half of the drivers.
So will that then strengthen, say, a class divide?
Putting a charge to drive to the city is not going to have an effect that divides people into who can and can't access the city, because we know that it's only a minority of people who come by car. Most people come on public transport already, and we're not seeing a class divide there.
Is the three-stage reform a better solution to congestion than new roads or more public transport?
We think that congestion charging should be the centrepiece of a mixed set of strategies to target congestion. And the reason for that is that we've seen decades of public transport and road investment, particularly road investment, and that's led us to the level of congestion we have today, which we think is too high. So when governments rule out congestion charging, they're asking motorists and they're asking the Australian people to accept the status quo, to accept more investment in roads, more investment in public transport. But that, we know, has led to this level of congestion. So it's time to try something new. And where massive infrastructure projects cost huge amounts for all households, so take, for example, WestConnex in Sydney, it's a $17 billion project. Northeast Link in Melbourne, $16 billion project. That's about $10,000 from every single household in those cities. A congestion charge, on the other hand, would have a similar effect on speeds across the network. But instead of charging every household $10,000 in taxes, it charges a few households, about 3% of households every day, and it charges them a few dollars to come in the morning and to go out again in the afternoon. So it's a much better way to achieve a reduction in congestion with a lower tax burden for Australian taxpayers.
Associate at the Grattan Institute's Transport and Cities team, James Ha, speaking there with Samantha Smith. With rallies of more action against climate change ramping up in recent weeks, the stance governments and businesses have taken on the issue has become more obvious. Governments in particular have begun outlawing climate-themed protests, such as the London Metropolitan Police banning Extinction Rebellion. A workshop moderated by former Minister of Foreign Affairs Bob Carr at the University of Technology Sydney is exploring how to change the discussion around climate change to get more support from people in power. Kevin Suarez, our CEO of the Carbon Market Institute, and workshop panellist John Connor, how businesses have been influenced by the recent rallies against climate change.
Well, I think business is being impacted on a range of fronts. They're certainly seeing that from those concerns from the community. They're seeing the concerns from the science. They're actually also seeing concerns now being raised by unlikely stakeholders like the heads of central banks and investors in terms of the superannuation funds, beginning to realise that this is as much an economic issue as anything else.
And are some businesses likely to adapt or adopt to avoid or prevent climate change and its impacts?
Yeah, indeed. And I think we're seeing, there's a great range. Some say that this is one of the greatest market opportunities in history as well as perhaps one of the greatest repair jobs we need to do. So there are significant opportunities. There are trillions that need to be invested in this, and the smart people are realising that they can move towards that. It's the challenge in this is that, as anything else, it's political economy, stupid. We've got to engage with what's the structures and systems and organisations as they exist, and we've got to make that move from there.
And how are some businesses that are more likely to contribute more to climate change, how would they be able to adapt if possible?
Well, we're seeing companies like Rio Tinto getting out of thermal coal. We are seeing the growth of renewable energy companies and companies like AGL, Australia's biggest polluter, changing its profile and portfolio. BHP's doing similar things. They're recognising and thinking ahead to what a net zero emissions and below economy looks like. Some of their challenges are what's profitable in the short term, what's the politics of that look like, and is there sufficient policy to guide that and give some confidence for them to be able to make the bigger investments behind that.
And for mining companies, is it realistic that they would be able to transfer their workforce into something more environmentally sustainable?
Yes, I think we're going to need mining for some time yet. It's a question of what we mine and how we manage the impacts of that mining. So we will need to manage that transition, but we're also, there are things, lithium, the rare materials, we're looking at ways in which we can make hydrogen as part of a net zero or the transition to a net zero emissions economy. So certainly there's opportunities there, but we've also got to deal with the transition from affected communities around some of the other mining and other operations as they make that transition.
Have previous efforts such as the controversial climate tax affected more recent efforts to address the issue by companies and individuals alike?
Well, I think we're still dealing with what's been 10 or more years now of controversy around the kind of policy responses and some tribal responses effectively to that. So we're certainly still dealing with that. We're dealing with second, third order best policy mechanisms from the Carbon Market Institute. We actually think good markets, well-designed markets, can deliver at the speed and the scale that we need. And we're looking to work from the basis that we have to turn what are some taxpayer-funded markets into business-driven markets, and that opportunity is there.
Could our approach to discussing climate change with politicians and businesses be different to make the topic a bit more accessible to them to perhaps get involved to make a change?
Yeah, look, I think we can change the way in which we talk about this, and I think we have been. I think there's certainly a realisation that we are now in a climate crisis. There's a whole range of impacts that are happening now, and I think that's just changing the debate even from 10 years ago, when we were certainly seeing some of those impacts then, but not perhaps in a systemic way. And I think there's an opportunity to take this to a positive narrative around repair. The reality is now we've passed the threshold of even of net zero emissions. We're going to need to be building economies that draw down carbon from the atmosphere, the heat-trapping gases. We're going to need to have regenerative agriculture and regenerative economics, which actually repairs some of our ecosystems. And I think that's a more inclusive way of engaging people with this debate. And it's, amongst other things, it's a reality we're going to need if we're going to keep any hope of a safe climate for our future.
CEO of the Carbon Market Institute, John Connor, ending that report by Kevin Suarez.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
US President Donald Trump authorised sanctions against Turkey today over its military offensive in northeast Syria. The move comes 1 week after he ordered American troops out of the autonomous Kurdish region known as Rojava, and one day after the ethnic Kurdish fighters were forced to join forces with Syria's Russian and Iranian-backed Assad regime. The deal will likely bring forces loyal to Syria's President Assad back into towns and cities that have been under autonomous Kurdish control for 7 years. Jeanette Stephen has the story.
Suresh Azadi is a Spanish volunteer and environment activist working in the internationalist commune of Rojava, based in the small border city of Derek in Syria. The group of international volunteers had been working with Kurdish youth on building community projects like gardens until the Turkish soldiers arrived.
There's been some shelling of the city where I'm located, so we've heard like some explosions. There's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of stress, because like we didn't come here to fight or anything. We all knew like when coming here, like of course we know that it's the Syrian civil war, but we wouldn't expect it actually like to really happen like in such what is like at least the threat is of a total war.
Suresh said the joining of the Kurdish fighters with Assad's Syrian troops should be viewed as a pragmatic alliance.
And like it's like the least worst option that we have. Like in the first place, this war is imposed on us. Like nobody here wanted this war to happen. And there's a history like of repression of the people here by the Syrian regime.
Hopes are, however, ultimately high for peace in light of the alliance and today's US sanctions on Turkey.
A lot of us here like don't have any experience of war, so it's hard to predict. Hopefully, like we can hope for a peace treaty to happen. Now there's the help from the Syrian regime, but also that the US also take their responsibility and play their role, not as a police force, but more as a mediator.
The US decision to fall back from the front lines, leaving the Kurdish forces to fend for themselves, has left a bitter taste for many locals. And even with sanctions imposed against Turkey and its interests, the lack of boots on the ground is being felt.
In the end, like a lot of international solidarity is expressed, but like we don't see anything happening. Like in actions that are being taken by either big forces or by the communities.
The release of captured Islamic State fighters from the border camps is one development that Associate Professor Mehmet Özalp from Charles Sturt University says requires cautious observation in the coming weeks and months.
Well, we can't expect the Kurdish forces and the Turkish forces to have a gentleman's handover agreement on the concentration camps where ISIS fighters were housed. So they will just abandon, and they may, ISIS fighters may use that as an opportunity to escape. We're not going to get a political entity called ISIS. However, their fighters could spread out and stage guerrilla warfare in Syria and beyond.
Meanwhile, Kurds in Australia are feeling hopeless and heartbroken, says the co-chair of the Federation of Democratic Kurdish Society of Australia, despite acquiring the extra muscle of Syria's soldiers behind them.
They didn't have any other choice to have an agreement with Assad and Russia, which is Assad and Russia, they always want to do that. And that was the plan from beginning.
İsmet Tezatan is a Kurdish-Australian living in Sydney, and he says there's an old saying in the Kurdish language that best describes the current situation.
There's a very famous Kurdish word was there, no mountain, no friend except mountain. That's, I think, we history tells us, and we are look like we don't have any other friends.
İsmet Tezatan from the Federation of Democratic Kurdish Society in Australia, ending that story on the Syrian conflict by Jeanette Stephen. The humble mango faces its greatest existential crisis as farmers face the effects of climate change upon their harvest of the golden fruit. Soil scientists suggest a possible long-term solution is the breeding of climate-resistant crops. But will it work? Bageshri Savariosashi has more.
Martina Matzner is the public officer for the Northern Territory Farmers Association. She also runs and manages a mango farm where she has noticed her crops being affected by the climate crisis.
We certainly have experienced quite significant changes in weather patterns, which very likely are related to, you know, climate change.
And while Martina bears witness to these changes on the ground, David Rowling from the Queensland University of Technology finds this phenomenon nothing out of the ordinary.
I think the farmers need to be proactive because, particularly in these really sensitive industries, they need to survive. So it doesn't surprise me at all. Some crops are more sensitive to specific changes in climate, so whether that's the effects it's going to have on mango flowering, you only need a 1 or 2 degree increase in wintertide temperatures to affect that sort of process.
The soil scientist also suggests a possible long-term solution to making crops climate change resistant and help them withstand extreme conditions.
Probably the best long-term method is always going to be plant breeding. So to try and manipulate the genetics of the plant material either through conventional breeding or through modification, to be able to handle either extremes better or, you know, droughts, or even with those specific things with mangoes where we're looking at, only a few degree increases during wintertime can make a big difference to the flowering windows and obviously then the fruit production. We need to be able to maybe whether it's different varieties from tropical Asia that come through or modification of our own varieties, just need to be better plant breeding programs.
While advances in plant breeding can help sustain food crops, David also looks to the government to make it easier for farmers to look after their crops in the current climate crisis.
Improved agronomic practices ensure that we have enough flexibility and security within our system to be able to handle these extremes, whether that's in the financial side of things and, you know, allowing farmers to handle more crop losses or actually give them better security. And additionally, maybe some even increased infrastructure to handle things like extreme rain events or hail events, which, you know, might actually come out and wipe out the crops as well. And, of course, better infrastructure for drought.
Martina agrees and is counting on support from the Northern Territory government. She's confident of the future of mango farming in the era of climate change.
I think we need to look at all of this and really work together as a collaboration. We really need to ensure that the awareness is there and, as I just said, that we find the challenges and then find solution to it. And the government certainly is part of this, and the Northern Territory government, just the Department of Primary Industry, just started this pilot program, which is very, very interesting and also exciting. So, we're very proactive in regards to tackling the potential challenges. But, I have no doubt that future mango farming will continue.
Martina Matzner from the Northern Territory Farmers Association, ending that report by Bageshri Saviasachi.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network. The Mother Mary and Jesus Christ have had a makeover. Over the last 3 years, Our Lady of the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Alice Springs have commissioned an Aboriginal artist from their congregation in Kathleen Wallace to design a new sanctuary window celebrating the blending of Catholic and Indigenous beliefs. The window is one of the first of its kind and is said to symbolise how far the Church has come in its relations with the Indigenous community. Andrew Herlinger asked Father Azalee Ross, the parish priest of Alice Springs, why are Aboriginal people embracing Catholicism?
Catholicism started in Central Australia way back in the mid-1920s, and the work of evangelization and education started since then. I strongly feel it's to do with a natural affinity between Catholicism and the First Peoples, and that's to do with rituals, symbols that are common between Catholicism and the Arantha way of understanding religion and the mystery we call God today.
The Catholic Church were once missionaries that encouraged Aboriginal people to abandon their language and belief systems. How have the Catholic Church changed since then?
So Vatican II supported the theology or the idea that local people express themselves through their own culture, you know, and that they should be able to express their, let's say, their Catholicism through that cultural world view. For example, when our first missionaries arrived, they were having problems with the smoking ceremony. But then we realized, well, we Catholics also do smoking in church. And so we have more in common now than ever before. For example, smoking. Smoking is now a form of healing and purification and reconciliation. So we use smoking in the church, performed by the Aranda peoples. Also because we have seen throughout the years since the 1920s, the deep-seated wisdom and theologies have not been discovered ever before. So we're trying to respect more now and trying to learn from their own way of looking at life in general.
Stained glass windows have a certain significance to the Catholic Church. Are there any other ways that the Catholic churches are commemorating their Indigenous congregations?
Yes, we are trying to bring the mainstream, let's say, Catholicism and the Arantha spiritualities together. In Alice Springs, it's a hard town, but it's a lovely town as well. It's kind of difficult now, especially for newcomers to understand the plight of Aboriginal peoples. So we are trying to, you know, day by day bring about an awareness of the First Peoples of the land and some of the struggles they are facing today, and also highlight that they have a lot to contribute.
Do you feel that the whole church, including the Indigenous community, embraces the church and considers it as their home?
Well, that's the hope. The painting was given by Kathleen Wallace on behalf of her Aboriginal Arantha communities, not only to the parish as we celebrate 50 years and 90 years of Catholic presence, but we fully supported it because we wanted them to feel at home in a church building. So when they come in, we hope they, meaning our Aranda people in town, not just the Catholics, I hope that they feel at home, that this is their place. I can pray and, you know, be with other people from other nations. Kathleen Wallace is very happy that her ancestral stories have now been included in the story of let's say, salvation history, the story of Jesus and Martha Mary. It was a moving moment when they opened this new window, and I hope it'll become maybe like a tourist attraction. People can come and have a look. The Aboriginal Jesus and the Aboriginal Mother Mary.
Father Asali Russ, the parish priest of Our Lady of the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Alice Springs, speaking there with Andrew Herlinger. That's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can subscribe to our podcast on any download app. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. The Wire is a team effort by 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide in Adelaide, and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. And you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so you tune in again then. And today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. And here, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Thanks for your company. Yes, and that was The Wire. I'm Roderick Chambers. I'm back again with you here on 2SER 107.3 because we're just asking for a little bit of help like we do at this time every year. It's only once a year, so I know if you've been listening a lot today, you may have heard this message more than once. But if you're just tuning in, look, it's the time that we ask for a bit of support from you, and we ask you to give us a call on 95149500. Just give us a call now. There's some people on the phones now that are more than happy to have a bit of chat with you about 2SER and how you can support us. We've, of course, on our 40th year here at 2SER, so it's quite a long time, and it's actually a 15th year birthday celebrations too. We've got more birthday celebrations coming along for The Wire, and that's our flagship current affairs program, which I've had the privilege to be on for a number of years now, and actually the EP of which is great. I really enjoy being on The Wire, and it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to get your teeth into some serious stories and current affairs that you don't often get the opportunity for otherwise. And, of course, what we have here on 2SER is something that you don't hear otherwise. So it's a good reason to give us a call on 9514 9500. And you can sign up for just like $40 if you're a concession, $80 if standard. And, look, if you get passionate, which is $160, and lifetime member, you never have to call us again, at $600, you get a free T-shirt. And if you're a lifetimer, you get a gift pack as well with lots of CDs and merchandise and really good stuff. So it's worthwhile giving us a call, 9514 9500. Say that you like listening to The Wire, because that then will mean that, you know, there's people out there wanting to hear us to keep going, to keep training people. We do a lot of training here at 2SER, and from my point of view, we're training a lot of young journalists, and I know a lot of our young people have gone on to better career, well, not better careers, but to really good careers in journalism at the ABC, Channel 10, SBS, a lot of places, Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, Telegraph. It's been wonderful seeing these people come through our station and learn stuff here that they can use elsewhere and find out stuff, find out things that you perhaps don't hear elsewhere. And that's why you should give us a call, 9514 9500, or, you know, hop on a computer, get onto the web, 2scr.com/support, and you can do it all online if you don't want to give us a call. But look, give us a call. We've got some people there. You can ask them a few questions about what it's like being here at 2SER. They're all volunteers here as well. So give us a call, 9514 9500. Support The Wire, support current affairs, support news. We've got independent news here from 6 a.m. till 12 p.m. with Jeff Field. This sort of stuff isn't available in most stations, and it's 2SER that does that, and it's a big ask in many ways. But give us a call, 9514 9500. We're doing the best that we can for you, and we hope that you can give us a call. Give us a call right now.